July 20, 1921. The Atlantic Ocean, about 60 miles off the Virginia coast, you're standing on the deck of an observation ship, field glasses around your neck, watching. Out there on the water, anchored and waiting, is a battleship. The Ostfriesland, a German dreadnought built before the First World War, designed to absorb punishment and stay afloat. She fought at Jutland in 1916, the biggest naval battle of the war, and she survived it. She hit a mine on the way home and survived that too. The American Navy was confident she would survive what was coming next. Up above, the sky was filling with aircraft. Army Air Service bombers. You could hear the engines before you could see them. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today, we are going back to that summer over the Atlantic, when a general named Billy Mitchell decided to settle an argument the only way he knew how, by winning it in the air. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com to understand what happened out over the Atlantic in July of 1921. You have to understand who Billy Mitchell was and what he had seen. William Billy Mitchell was born in 1879, the son of a United States senator from Wisconsin. He enlisted to fight in the Spanish-American War at 18 years old. He was smart, ambitious, and by the time the First World War started, he had already served in Cuba, the Philippines, and Alaska. He was a career officer who understood strategy the way some people understand music, instinctively, completely, and then he got into airplanes. He was one of the first senior Army officers to actually learn to fly, not ride along as a passenger fly. He earned his wings at age 36, which even by the standards of the day was not a young age to be starting. But Billy Mitchell had a way of turning stubbornness into a tool. What he saw over France changed him permanently. He watched aircraft evolve from fragile cloth and wire scouts in 1914 into bombers and fighters that shaped the battle below them. At the Battle of Saint-Mihiel in September of 1918, Mitchell commanded the largest air armada ever assembled, 1,500 aircraft, American, French, British, all of them, under his coordination. 1,500 airplanes, in the second decade of aviation. Think about that. He came home from Europe convinced of something that put him directly at odds with nearly every admiral in the United States Navy. He believed the battleship was already obsolete, not on its way out. Already finished, a capital ship sitting at anchor in a harbor, he argued, was nothing more than a very expensive target for aircraft. He said the future of naval warfare wasn't going to be decided on the water. It was going to be decided above it. The Navy, naturally, did not care for this opinion. The end of the First World War had left a fleet of surrendered German warships in American hands, part of the terms of the armistice, and somebody got the idea of using them as test targets. The Navy agreed. They expected the test to prove their point, that yes, aircraft could damage ships, but a genuine capital ship could not be sunk from the air. They wrote the rules of engagement accordingly. Bombing runs in sequence, pauses between each run so observers could assess damage, restrictions on bomb size, methodical, scientific, and in the Navy's estimation, reassuring. The test started in June of 1921 with smaller vessels, a German destroyer, a cruiser called the Frankfurt. Mitchell's bombers sank both of them. Then came the Ostfriesland. She was approximately 22,000 tons of German naval engineering, launched in 1909, commissioned in 1911. Her hull was designed with watertight compartments intended to keep her afloat even after taking serious damage. At Jutland, she had absorbed shell fire from British warships and come home. The American Navy pointed to her as proof that aircraft bombs could not sink a well-built battleship. On July 20th, Navy aircraft made the first runs, 300-pound bombs, 600-pound bombs, multiple hits. The Ostfriesland was damaged, taking on water, listing. But when the day ended, The rules said the runs would happen in sequence, with ceasefire intervals so observers could approach the ship and assess what the bombs had done. Mitchell's bombers made a pass. The ceasefire signal went up. The bombers came around again. Signal again, a third pass. At some point, the officers on the observation ships weren't watching through their field glasses to assess damage. They were watching because they could not look away. Here is the thing nobody had fully calculated. The 2,000-pound bombs that landed in the water close alongside the ship, the near misses, were generating hydrostatic shockwaves. The pressure from those explosions underwater was rupturing the seams of those carefully engineered watertight compartments from the outside. The design that was supposed to keep the Ostfriesland alive was failing in a way that nobody, not the German engineers who built her and not the American admirals who trusted in her, had anticipated. 21 minutes, that is how long the Ostfriesland lasted. Once Mitchell's heavy bombers went to work on the morning of July 21, 1921. 21 minutes, and somewhere around 22,000 tons of German steel was on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, in 170 feet of water. The Navy observers were furious. Mitchell had pushed past the ceasefire protocols. He'd made the test look easy when it was supposed to be complicated, controlled, inconclusive enough to be argued about. But the ship was on the bottom of the ocean, and there is no argument with that. Mitchell held a press conference. He was not what you would call a diplomatic man, and he did not conduct himself like one. He told reporters that the battleship was finished as a weapon of war, that aircraft could sink anything that floated, that the admirals who disagreed with him were looking backward. Newspapers loved it. Congress paid attention. The Navy seethed. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because Billy Mitchell was completely right about the technology and almost completely wrong about how to manage being right. He kept pushing. Articles, lectures, congressional testimony. He argued that the United States needed an independent air arm, a unified air command separate from both the Army and the Navy, the same way Britain had built its Royal Air Force after the First World War. He argued that air power was going to decide the next war before the infantry ever got to the field. In 1924, he wrote an intelligence assessment, and I want to pause on this because what he put in that report is something you have to read to believe. He predicted that Japan would attack American territory in the Pacific. He predicted the attack would target Hawaii and the Philippines. He predicted it would come by carrier-based aircraft. He even wrote that Sunday morning was the most likely time for a surprise attack, when American forces would be least ready. He wrote all of that 17 years before December 7, 1941. You can find that report today. The Air Force Historical Research Agency has it, read it, and the hair on your arms will stand up. But in Washington in 1924, nobody in a position to act on it wanted to hear it. The breaking point came in September of 1925, a Navy dirigible, the USS Shenandoah, the first rigid airship built in America, ran into severe weather over Ohio and broke apart in the sky. 14 men died. The Shenandoah had been on a public relations tour over the Midwest against the advice of her own commanding officer, who had argued the flight was too risky for that time of year. Mitchell issued a statement, and here is where, if you're being completely honest about the man, you have to say he went further than a serving officer could go and survive. He called the deaths the result of, quote, the almost treasonable administration of the national defense by senior Army and Navy officials. He named names. He accused men of criminal negligence in front of the press. There is no world in which that ends well for a serving officer, and it did not. The court-martial convened on October 28, 1925. It ran 7 weeks. The charge was conduct prejudicial to good order and military discipline. The verdict was guilty. He was suspended from duty for 5 years at half pay. Billy Mitchell resigned his commission in February of 1926. He was 46 years old. He spent the next decade writing and lecturing, warning anyone who would listen that America was not prepared for what was coming. He talked about Japan specifically. He talked about what would happen to ships moored in harbor when the bombs started falling. He died on February 19, 1936. He never saw December 7, 1941. But when the news came out of Pearl Harbor that Sunday morning, when the first reports reached Washington that Japanese aircraft had struck, that the battleships were burning, that the Arizona was going down, that the Oklahoma had capsized at her moorings, one of the first things people started saying was that Mitchell had been right. Congress passed legislation in 1946 to restore his rank and promote him to Major General, posthumously. 3 years after that, in 1949, the United States Army Air Forces became the United States Air Force, an independent service branch, exactly what Mitchell had spent his career fighting to create. He had been dead for 13 years. The bombers that Jimmy Doolittle flew off the deck of the Hornet in 1942 were called B-25 Mitchells, named after him. That felt right. Aviation has a complicated relationship with the people who see the future before everyone else. They tend to be inconvenient while they are alive, and monuments once history proves them out. The Ostfriesland is still down there, about 60 miles off Cape Charles, Virginia, 170 feet of water over her. Divers have visited her. She has been on the bottom for over 100 years. In some ways, she is still doing what Billy Mitchell needed her to do, sitting there as proof of what he knew and what it cost him to say it out loud. I think about those Navy officers on the observation ships, watching through their field glasses on July 21st as a battleship they believed in disappeared in 21 minutes. Not the anger that came later, in that first moment, just the silence, because they had seen the future and it had wings. For the history in this segment, I leaned on accounts from the Air Force Historical Research Agency, Alan Wilt's research on the 1921 bombing tests, and Alfred Hurley's biography of Mitchell. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the blue side up.